They are my friends and that are running in the Green Party ticket. I know them. They're good, and they're not going to drop out, I'm pretty sure of that, too.
Shouldn't those that are running earn those votes, or do they take them for granted?
I think they should earn those votes, and they do run hard. And I know Jill and Sherry Hancala, and they're going to run hard. They're very good people, and they're serious organizers. And they talk about issues that get ignored, but the system is stacked. So at the end of the day, they don't get to play in the finals. They don't even get invited to the semis. You know, so.
62 votes. All righty, so we're going to go to Mark Babawi.
Thank you, Mark. It's time to do our thank yous.
It is time to wrap up. This is actually not Fox News coverage. This is Pacifica. proud to say Pacifica. Maybe that listener can send us an email with some more information. This does it for the second day of the National Democratic Convention coverage here from Charlotte, North Carolina. The show was produced by Deanna Martinez, Stephanie Hendricks, and Mitch Jezerich. The engineers are John Almale, Otis McClay, Dev Ross, and Michael Yoshida. Jill Montgomery is our board operator at KPFA. We had some pieces produced on the show by Thelonious Axe and Evan Davis. Please tune in tomorrow, 8 p.m. Eastern Time to 5 p.m. Pacific. Coverage of day three at the DNC for David D. and Margaret Prescott. This is Mark Barry. Thanks for listening.
Board of Education. Women first voted in city elections in 1887 and elected the state's first woman mayor in 1888. And we ratified the Equal Rights Amendment in the early 1970s.
Madam Secretary, the great state of Kansas, the home of the University of Kansas Jayhawks, the Kansas State Wildcats, and the Wichita State University Shockers are extraordinarily proud of our former governor, Kathleen Sebelius, who currently serves as Secretary of Health and Human Resources. And finally, Madam Secretary, Kansans are proud of President Dwight David Eisenhower, Nancy Kassebaum, and Bob Dole, whose moderation and common sense wisdom have been repudiated by the Republican Party and replaced by the extremism of Ayn Rand, Rush Limbaugh, Glenn Beck, Sam Brownback, and the Koch brothers.
Yes.
For all the reasons that we heard today, and because we believe in the future, Kansas proudly casts 51 votes for President Barack Obama.
Thank you, Kansas. Kansas casts 51 votes for Barack Obama. Kentucky, you have 73 votes.
Madam Secretary, the great Commonwealth of Kentucky, the home of Kentucky Bourbon, the Kentucky Derby, and championship basketball. Kentucky, which last year showed the nation how Democrats can win in the South, and where this year we will re-elect Congressman John Yarmuth and Ben Chandler.
And this is WBAI in New York, part of the Pacifica Radio Network, broadcasting at 99.5 megahertz FM. I'm Robert Knight, inviting you to stay tuned for this special election edition of Earthwatch.
The bell for freedom still rings. The bell for freedom still rings. Sorrow to me, but does it ring to know the bell of freedom still rings? The hammer for justice still pounds. The hammer for justice still pounds. Heavy is the beating sound of the hammer for justice that pounds.
Greetings and welcome to this special edition of Earthwatch on the 6th of September 2012. I'm Robert Knight in New York and you're tuned to WBAI 99.5 FM. And we now review a portion of the Democratic National Convention in Charlotte, North Carolina that earlier this evening went south, as it were, as it turned from the family values rhetoric of Tuesday evening into more controversy over a number of things, including the re-inclusion of God in the Democratic Party platform and a vote to recognize Jerusalem instead of Tel Aviv as the capital of Israel after a conservative pushback on the party platform. Those issues, along with inaccurate statements on the economy, came up in the early hours of the Pacifica Radio Network national coverage of this event, and we now hear those developments as they occurred.
The innocent one still died. The innocent one still died. We can't value life too high if the innocent one still died.
Welcome to Pacifica Radio's live coverage of the Democratic National Convention in Charlotte, North Carolina. It's the second night of the DNC, and the keynote speaker this evening is Bill Clinton. Elizabeth Warren will also have a prime spot this evening. We'll hear both of those speeches in their entirety. We will also go outside the convention walls and security perimeters for the latest on demonstrations throughout Charlotte. Our guests this evening include economist Richard Wolff and Dean Baker, civil rights activist and famed writer Amiri Baraka, John Nichols of The Nation magazine, and political strategist Steve Cobble. We'll also take a hard look at the reality of the campaign to suppress the vote with Barbara Arnwine of the Lawyers Committee for Civil Rights, Biko Baker, Jazzery X, Senator Barbara Boxer, and Congresswoman Karen Bass. All of that and more next on Pacifica Radio's live coverage of the National Democratic Convention. Stay tuned. All in the house with me, this is Margaret Prescott, host of Sojourner Truth out of KPFK in Southern California. In the house with me, co-hosting Davey D of KPFA up in Northern California. Davey D, how you doing this evening?
It's pretty intense, you know. I mean, a lot of stuff is going on in people's minds, especially the issue of the evening, voter suppression, among other things. A lot of people are concerned that what happened in 2000 is going to happen in 2012. And so I'm glad we're going to be really addressing that full throttle tonight.
All righty. And also in the house, Mark Bebowie of KPFT in Houston. And Mark, you've been around the convention halls today.
I have. I've been talking to the delegates, a couple of members of Congress and senators, and we are going to talk about the economics as well later tonight. Warren is speaking, and we have a couple of very distinguished economists, so that's going to be very interesting for me.
All righty. Well, we're gonna go for it. We're going to go right for it. And I would like to introduce Congresswoman Karen Bass. Congresswoman Bass, thank you so very much for joining us.
Thanks for having me on, Margaret.
Congresswoman Karen Bass, the representative from California's 33rd Congressional District. She is a member of a number of committees, but I really have to mention that prior to her election to Congress in 2010, she served as a member of the California State Assembly, representing the 47th District since 2004. From 2008 to 2010, she served as Speaker of the California State Assembly, becoming the second woman and only the third African American to serve in that post. And I must say, prior to that, which is when I first met Karen Bass,
was
a community organizer in South LA, like President Obama, starting out as a community organizer, Karen.
That's right. Just decided to go inside, but the struggle is the same.
That's right. Karen also sits on the House Committee on the Budget House Committee on Foreign Affairs. She's a ranking member subcommittee on Africa and Global Health, a member of the subcommittee on international organizations, human rights, and oversight. And Karen, just kicking us off, during this first hour, we're going to be focusing on the really serious and scary issue of voter suppression.
That's right.
Huge in this election period. Mm-hmm. Congresswoman Bass.
Absolutely. And, you know, I think the issue that they're talking about in the country as to whether or not there's a loss of enthusiasm for the president, I happen to think that there isn't. And I know that they believe that, too. That's why they feel that the only way they can win is to prevent us from voting. And what a contradiction it is. We celebrate the purple thumbs of folks in Afghanistan and Iraq, and we do everything we can to prevent people from voting in our own country.
You know, when we discuss this issue, it's often framed as, well, it's just really a simple thing. Just get ID. Everybody needs to get ID. You know, you sitting in Congress, how is this really playing out? What's really underscoring that? And why isn't it just a simple thing of getting ID?
Well, you know, and I do think that that causes a lot of confusion because people think, well, you need an ID to get on an airplane. But, you know, there's a whole lot of people in a whole lot of communities that aren't getting on airplanes, that don't drive cars, that are elderly, that are disabled. And the ID is expensive. So as far as I'm concerned, in a lot of countries, when you talk about voter ID, you're just talking about a poll tax. And so what that has led to us having to do is to raise the money to pay for those voter IDs, because at this point in time, we're not going to be able to overturn the decisions in certain states. Now, the Department of Justice has stopped several of them, but, you know, over 30 states introduced legislation to restrict voting rights, and I really think it's important that we call it for what it is.
I know that it being that it's state rights in terms of how voting's regulated, what can Congress do to make it easy for people to get ID and we just be done with it?
Well, you know, I mean, it is a problem because in this particular Congress with the Tea Party that took over the Republican Party, there isn't anything that we can do, and that's unfortunate. However, it's the Department of Justice that does have the power in certain situations to go in and overturn a decision or to challenge it in court.
There's one thing I wanted to point out on this issue, which I think gets lost in the analysis and the discussion sometimes. One is that the number of people who have been found, you know, trying to commit voting fraud is so minuscule.
Exactly.
I mean, it's practically non-existent, and that gets lost. And the other thing that gets lost, and I hopefully you can comment on this, is how narrow the margins are in some states. And so if votes are suppressed by the order of 1 or 2%, that can actually affect the outcome. So we're not talking about, you know, 25% of the vote being affected by this.
Oh, and what did we see in the year 2000? I mean, it caught us by surprise then, but we know about it now. I mean, we know that they purged the rolls in Florida of African-American voters, and they used the pretext of people who had convictions. And this time we know Florida, for example, was trying to eliminate Latino voters by going after Spanish surnames and saying you needed to prove whether you were a citizen. A lot of people have described this as a solution in search of a problem because there is virtually no voter fraud that warranted this. But there is a conservative right-wing organization called ALAC, and I forget what the initial stands for, that encouraged state legislators to introduce legislation. Now, we're fortunate in California, and I know this is beyond California, we're not subjected to this because this could never happen in our state legislature. But like I said, there's over 30 states where laws were introduced. They didn't all pass. They didn't all come up. But there's a number of states that are affected, and virtually all the states in the South.
Congresswoman Bassett, we know that you have to roll pretty soon, and you actually spoke to the convention this evening, and congratulations on that.
Thank you.
One thing I wanted you to really comment on is that in an election year, the usual debate that happens among social change activists and progressives is taking place. Some people are saying, forget the mainstream parties. We just have to go for alternative parties. Some people are saying, well, they're all alike. There's no difference between the two. Why the heck should people go out and vote?
Then you
have a whole set of folks that are saying, listen, with this voter suppression stuff, we got to go out and vote. Whoever you vote for, even for the third party candidate, you've been out on the streets as a community organizer.
Right.
You've been deep in it.
Right.
And now you are on the inside. You're your comment.
I just have to tell you, and Margaret, you know me because we've known each other for several decades, but I just have to tell you, the distinction between the Democrats and the Republicans, first of all, the Republicans have been taken over by the Tea Party, and the Tea Party is an entire front for the Koch brothers and for a handful of billionaires. People need to read Paul Ryan. Paul Ryan has put his stuff down in black and white. You can call Mitt Romney the Etch-a-Sketch guy because he is whatever the way the wind blows. Paul Ryan is a hardcore right-wing ideologue who has written, in my opinion, the manifesto against the American people, and it's called The Path to Prosperity. They are talking about fundamentally changing our country from privatizing Social Security to turning Medicaid into a voucher program to eliminating the Department of Education. So I think that this election is more important than any that I have seen in many, many, many decades. And so if anybody thinks that there is no difference today between the Democrats and the Republicans, please read the collected works of Paul Ryan.
All righty. Well, on that note, Congresswoman Karen Bass, thank you so very much for joining us.
Thanks for having me on.
All righty. All righty. Davey D., what do we have coming up next?
Well, what we want to do is we want to get into the beginning of our discussion around voter suppression. And what I want to do is bring to the table the conversation that we had with Barbara R. Arnwine. She was a sister that I got a chance to see throw down this Saturday, or actually it was Saturday that we had, Sunday, we had the March on Wall Street South. While that was going on, there was a huge, huge town hall meeting that was put together by the Hip Hop Caucus, BET, and a number of folks. About the same amount of people on that march were in this room, and what this sister had to say regarding voter suppression was just incredible. I want to bring her into the conversation that we had earlier today. Davey D. here, Charlotte, North Carolina. The live coverage of the DNC, Pacifica Radio. Davey D. here, along with Margaret Prescott on the boards. And in the building with us is somebody who tore it up the other day. For people, let me just paint the scene. During the historic Wall Street South March, which was packed with hundreds of people that marched around the convention center, at the same time, there was a huge town hall packed with about the same amount of people, mostly black, to participate in a voter suppression town hall. And the person of the hour is the woman in front of me, Barbara R. Arnwine, the president and executive director for the Lawyers Committee for Civil Rights. You set the house on fire.
Thank you.
I mean, everybody, thugs with gold teeth and chains, they was all riveted. And I've been telling people, ask Margaret, I've been bragging about this.
Yes, he told me about it. I felt bad. I wasn't there.
But we didn't know that y'all knew each other.
Yes, she's fantastic. I mean, one of the best people in this business. And I am just so happy to be part of this show today.
Yeah. Well, can you give us a rendition of what you were breaking down? Because you had maps, charts, and when everybody left, there was people, they didn't need you in the room because they're going to be voting.
That's
and
right.
Getting an ID and knowing how to fight back.
Thank you. Well, what I really brought to the audience was the fact that most people did not realize that since the new elections were held in 2010 and many state legislatures turned over and they had new members come over and take over the majority party, that they've been passing all these voter suppression laws. And these voter suppression laws could have tremendous impact on this upcoming election unless people are really aware of what they need to do and are educated about their rights under these new laws. So it's one of the biggest things that they've done is that they passed what are called voter ID laws, saying that the only way you can vote is that you must have a state-issued identification from your Department of Motor Vehicles, either a driver's license or a non-driver's license. Now, people hear that and they think, well, why is that so hard? But what people don't understand is that in 2008, 21 million people who voted did not have that kind of ID, do not own it. Of that 21 million, think about this, 5.5 African Americans do not have that kind of ID who are voters. So it can have tremendous impact. And the bad news is that once they passed these laws in 10 states, they did not publicize the passage of these laws. They have not reached out to people individually. So most people have no idea that these new laws exist. They're going to show up at the polling places and think they can vote on November 6th and find out for the first time that, oh, what do you mean I can't vote? And they're going to be given a provisional ballot which will not be counted in that state. So it is absolutely critical that if you are a voter and you do not know what your voting rights are in your state and you got a question, if you live in Texas, Mississippi, Alabama, Georgia, South Carolina, Tennessee, Kansas, Wisconsin, Indiana, or Pennsylvania, that you call us. Now, we have sued these states. We're not going to sit back and let them do this. After all the fight that Fannie Lou Hamer and Medgar Evers gave his life for, after everything we've gone through as a people, and as so many people have sacrificed of all races for this right to vote, we're not going to let them just take it away. So we have sued and put on hold the South Carolina law. We put on hold the Texas law. In fact, we just got it thrown out. Right. By a federal district court last week. We have put on hold the Mississippi law, the Alabama law, and we have gotten the Wisconsin law thrown out. And when I say we, that means civil rights legal organizations that have been fighting these battles, including the Lawyers Committee for Civil Rights under law. We are also litigating the Pennsylvania law. So we are hoping to really make a difference where people will be able to have their ability to vote. But you never know what the courts are going to do. People are going to appeal these. So you need to know what your rights are in those states. So call us at 1-866-OUR-VOTE. We have a national hotline.
Wait, say that number again because my pen broke.
Yes. We have a national hotline that's staffed by legal volunteers to help you with any questions you have about voting. And there's no question too small. You can call us at 1-866-OUR-VOTE. That's 1-866-687-8683. Anytime during business hours, 9 to 5, Monday through Friday. And if you are working and can't call us then, just call at any time and we will call back. We will return your call. In fact, we returned over 1,000 calls already.
Wow. Go ahead.
Yeah, Barbara, tell us about the kind of town hall meeting that you held here in Charlotte where people get so much information. Is this something going on in other cities and in other states? And also, I want you to underscore again how many people are disenfranchised, because I have a report here that the St. Petersburg Times, which is now the Tampa Bay Times, they noted that voter fraud is rarer than a shark attack, and that in the presidential election year of 2008, there were 28 shark attacks, but only 16 voter fraud cases. In 2010, shark attacks outnumbered voter fraud by 14 to 10. So what is really all of this about?
It's really about voter suppression. I mean, there have been the interviews done with the current head of the, with the former head of the RNC in Florida, who testified under oath in a deposition that they would sit in back rooms and talk about how to suppress the black vote. What kind of legislative schemes could they introduce to make it harder for blacks to vote? And let me tell you that not only is it these voter ID laws that I've been talking about, they've also made it cut back on early voting.
Yeah.
In both Florida and in Ohio, they tried it, but the Dems, I just run a lawsuit there.
Yeah.
They also have done that in many states, and people don't understand that the early voting was critical. In Florida, 50% of all African Americans who voted in 2008 voted early. And so they also, 30% of all those African-American voters voted on the Sunday before the election. So
right,
guess what day you cannot vote this election?
On the Sunday.
You can't take the souls to the polls on the Sunday before the election.
The thing that got me with which was most compelling for people that are listening, was that as they passed these laws, and you went through map by map,
yes,
you showed that how they had cut back simultaneously on DMVs and all the places that you could get the ID.
Exactly.
So, like, I know in Milwaukee, where there was a lot of work being done,
They had moved some of the DMV, so the nearest one was like 100 miles away, only open on 2 days a week, like between like 11 and 3. Well, and that was where you had to go to get your ID.
Not only that, I mean, because of all these budget cuts, we've all been hearing about budget cuts at the state level. One of the things they've been doing is making it hard for these DMVs to operate. So in Tennessee, where they have one of these voter ID laws, guess what? They do not have the Department of Motor Vehicles open 5 days a week.
Yeah.
And guess what? Only one is open on a Saturday. So what does that mean?
For the whole state.
For the whole state. I mean, so people need to understand that this is not, you know, easy. In fact, we busted the Board of Elections in Wisconsin and in Texas because they sent out flyers and directives to their Department of Motor Vehicles telling people not to tell voters that they could get free ID. They tell them not to tell them that they needed the ID. I mean, isn't that insane? I mean, if we're about a democracy and the most fundamental right of a democracy is the right to vote, then how can you be hiding it, making it difficult, making it inaccessible, and then telling people at the last minute that their vote won't be counted? This is not acceptable, people. The other thing they've been doing, which is really ugly, is cutting back on third-party registration groups. So the NAACP, League of Women Voters, Girl Scouts, Boy Scouts, all these civic groups that go out there and help people to register to vote, they cut it back. Guess what it's meant in Florida? In Florida, at this time, last election in 2008, over 219,000 new voters have been registered by third-party registration groups.
Wow.
This year, less than 11,000.
So, Barbara, put this in a political context for us. I mean, a lot of time and money, clearly, effort has gone into these voter suppression laws. Some are calling it the new poll tax.
Yes.
The politics behind that. Well, why such a huge effort and why now?
Because what happened was a lot of people who voted in 2008 did not vote in 2010. Over 20-something million people who voted in 2008 said
okay.
They set out the midterms. And those people who got into office, they figured it out. The average state contested election was won by less than 600 votes. The average contested congressional race was won by less than 2,000 votes. They said if those 20 million people come back in the presidential, we're out of office. So
okay.
What we're going to do is pass all these laws to make sure they can't come back, to make sure it's harder for them to vote. So this is very politically motivated. It's really, you know, designed to, you know, to just steal the election in some ways, but really to block voters who
right.
people don't like.
And it's not
so they don't like youth voters. They don't like
right.
black voters, Latino voters, Native American voters, Asian voters. They don't like, you know, so they make it harder for the elderly, harder for the people with disabilities. All these communities are going to be negatively impacted by these new laws.
How many people are we talking about?
Over, so far in the states that have passed these laws, it's over 5 million. But we also estimate that was done on a research before some states have passed. So let me give you an estimate. In the state of Florida, in the state of Pennsylvania, 1 million people.
Yeah.
In the state of Texas, 1 million plus people. In the state of Wisconsin, 350,000 people. In the state of South Carolina, 350 plus thousand.
And the most
people.
Egregious thing now is that the ALEC groups and all that behind them are also putting in money to do a couple of things, misinformation campaigns. One of them is to tell people that if you show up to get your driver's license,
all the deceptive practices.
Then you and you didn't pay your child support and all that.
Vicious.
And they're also putting money behind people who are saying don't vote because it don't matter. So you're
right.
Now starting to see these people get big
platforms.
And even
worse than that, I mean, you know, the deceptive practices are really dangerous, people. You're going to get these flyers that are going to say crazy things to you. And they're going to say things like, you can't vote. Are you going to be arrested at the polls if you did not pay your driver's, if you didn't pay your child support, your traffic tickets, your Comcast bill, your water bill, your electric bill? I mean, that's just wrong, people. They're going to say things like Democrats vote on Wednesdays. There are no elections on Wednesday. The election is on Tuesday, November 6th. Don't let anybody tell you otherwise. The other thing that's going to happen that's even worse than the deceptive practices is that True the Vote, which is the Tea Party, is out there recruiting 1 million challengers to go to black and brown precincts to harass black and brown voters. They're already active in Michigan, Ohio, and they are going to each and every county board of elections and telling them that they need to purge voters.
Yeah.
And just doing everything they can to make it harder for people. In addition to the poll challengers, they're going to actually, they're recruiting people to go inside the polls and be poll workers so that they can challenge people from the inside. This is all devious. It's all nefarious. And it all has only one purpose, and that's to make it sure that as many people who vote, who try to vote as possible, cannot vote, and to take away their rights. But the good news for everyone is that we're here. We're here to fight for you. We are not alone. There's a couple tools you need. Call that hotline.
Give that number again.
1-866 our vote. 1-866-687-8683. That is your lifeline. If you have any questions about voting, if you're an ex-felon, if you moved, you don't know which state you should vote in or which county you should vote in, you don't know if you need to re-register, call us. We will help you. If you're very into technology, we have a free mobile app. You can go to our website, lawyerscommittee.org, or 866.rvote.org. You can go to either one of them and get this free mobile app, and it will allow you to verify your registration, know what your polling place is, and you can do it for not only yourself, but anybody. You know, Yo-Yo Nim and all the rest of your buddies, you can find out in California, anywhere in this country, you can help them to register to vote.
Well, you just blew it up.
Broke it down. I had to say, preach on, Sister Barbara.
You just blew Michelle Obama out the water with that.
Lawyers.
Awesome list.
Lawyers Committee on Civil Rights, and such an important topic here. Thank you so very much for joining us, and thank you for taking the time.
Thank you for having us. Thank you.
And that was Barbara Arnwine, President and Executive Director of the Lawyers Committee for Civil Rights under the law since 1989. And another civil rights issue, a hot button issue right here, not only at this convention, but throughout the country. And we'd now like to welcome here joining us Mickey Costa, who is with VoiceHeard.com. Mickey, thank you so very much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
So, Mickey, the issue that you're really concerned and burning to talk to our audience about right now.
Yeah, I mean, gay marriage is on everybody's radar. I think most people would believe that in America, land of opportunity for all, that people have certain inalienable rights. And fundamental right of being able to marry who you choose is one of them. And having equal protection under the law kind of falls into that category very well. And they segue into each other nicely. This is an issue, if you check out our site, voiceheard.com, is something we will be talking about very shortly. And what we do there is kind of leave it up to you to decide what to do. This issue is a little bit easier. I think most people, it's a social, emotional issue. It's grounded in a constitutional framework, but people would agree on this more easily than something more complex like someone's budget plan. So anyway, the point is gay marriage is something that's on everyone's radar and something you can go to our site and find out a lot about, kind of what the arguments for and against it are, what the facts are for this type of issue.
And what's the site?
It's called VoiceHeard.com. It's a nonpartisan political networking site. It's centered around specific issues like gay marriage, where you can go on and people right now, if they feel strongly one way or the other, can group together and be empowered and have a voice that can be heard. Because they're coming together, whether it's doing petitions or events or votes, and they can have we have a very nice discussion board, and we have a great open dialogue between fellow citizens, and also your politicians now have a very good chance of hearing you and what you think. I think gay marriage is an important issue that people need to stand up on, and there's definitely a lot of voices out there right now, but they're not being aggregated in one place and not being heard effectively.
Were you surprised to see it officially adopted at the DNC platform, or were you expecting that?
I don't think anybody was expecting Biden to open his mouth as early as he did. But I think that the DNC camp, Democratic camp, is glad that he did. I think they're going to go with that anyway.
Did you catch Michelle's speech yesterday? What did you think of her reference?
I caught glimpses of it. I've been kind of busy traveling to get here. I thought she did a great job. I thought it was great how she didn't personally attack Romney, but kind of did in an underhanded way.
Well, I think the main thing with not just Michelle Obama, but everybody definitely made reference to the right for people to be able to love whoever it is that they love. And I think that's a big advancement. That's a lot of people were talking about that out on the streets today when I was around, that they felt that that was a big step forward. And a lot of the hoopla that seemed to suggest that somehow this was going to splinter folks in this room didn't really seem to bear out. I think the way it's being framed as a human rights right is something that I think many people, more than most would have expected, are embracing and kind of moving on.
I completely agree. I think there's a special unity within the Democratic camp itself on this issue, obviously. I think also across the board, if you look at a lot of Republican constituents throughout the country, you'd be surprised that a lot of them maybe don't fundamentally agree with this, and they tend to vote Republican because they happen to be very fiscally conservative and disagree with the Democratic Party on those stances. And again, if people can come together on specific issues like gay marriage, it leaves room for a conversation to be had and connections to be made between people that might agree on gay marriage together, even though generally their principles are vastly different because they're in different parties.
Right, and we're expecting to hear from Barney Frank later in the hour. And, of course, he has come out and has also, you know, made a big difference on this issue. So, Mickey Costa, voiceheard.com. Thank you so very much for joining
Thank
us.
Thank you for having me, guys.
All righty.
Live from Charlotte, North Carolina, here at the Democratic National Convention. It is Pacifica Radio. My name is Davey D, along with Margaret Prescott, along also with Mark Babawi. We are all holding it down as things are kicking off. And walking in the building, there are two people that I think folks really need to know. Biko Baker, who is the executive director of the League of Young Voters, nationally recognized for his work in getting people to the polls. He is out of Milwaukee, and contrary to popular belief, he is one of the people that has set records in turning people out, especially in the midterms and the most recent election around Scott Walker. Sitting next to him is Jasiri X out of the great state of Pennsylvania, Pittsburgh to be exact. He is a well-known artist as well as an organizer who is on the ground also getting people to the polls. Gentlemen, welcome to the show, and let me just start off with you, Biko. The big topic of discussion, especially for people in our generation, is voter suppression, directed at black people, brown people, young people in general. You've been able to buck that trend in a state that has put voter ID and voter suppression tactics into play. Let's talk about the success and how you're doing things.
Well, first of all, I want to appreciate you guys and Pacifica for having me on and Jaziri on. And the second thing is, it's not me. You know, we have a cool team of smart young cats who are very passionate, bigger than the league in Milwaukee, and it's been about 8 years of cultivating people who want to stand up and fight for themselves. And what people don't know about Milwaukee is it's a mostly black city. And even though Happy Days and Laverne and Shirley are what people think about our city, it's black and brown. And the reason why we've been able to do that is because we use art, culture, and the internet to keep people informed. It's never knocking doors is the only tactic. We're constantly talking about voting. In the middle of winter and off your election, we're talking of voting and registered voters. So, you know, just keeping the message out there and keep it popping.
Let's talk about the Scott Walker recall election. Very big difference in terms of what you all did versus what the leadership of the Dems were able to do. Talk a little bit about that, the folks you turned out and where it went wrong.
Well, we're beefing with the Wisconsin Dems a little bit. Not really. But unfortunately, what's happened is that, you know, the state is divided by race and class. And unfortunately, the Wisconsin Democratic Party was not able to convince working class white men that it was in their self-interest to vote for Tom Barrett. Part of that is Tom Barrett's fault by starting a late election and not pushing real hard. But other is that the Democratic Party has not innovated its organizing strategy. And outside the Obama campaign, you see very little innovation. And so while we're at the front edge using data, science, and hood kids using technology and tracking, some of our elders in the white Democratic Party have not been doing that. I don't want to say white, but, you know, it's mostly white in Wisconsin.
Jasiri, talk about what's going on in Pennsylvania. You guys have a voter suppression thing going on there.
Absolutely.
But you were able to turn out a lot of people in 08. What's the sentiment now going into 2012? And also, Biko said using art, and you've been crafting songs.
Absolutely.
That have been very, very popular.
Right. Well, I mean, what's happening in Pennsylvania right now is they passed the voter ID law specifically to win the state for Mitt Romney. And we know this because the head of the Republican Party in Pennsylvania said it on videotape that we passed voter ID and this was, and so basically Romney's going to win. And so it's being challenged right now. You just had recently right in Pittsburgh at the DMV where somebody wrote a story about how they went to the DMV and was denied a ID to vote. And so, you know, it's very real. And so, you know, what's happening in Pittsburgh right now is we're really working in our communities to, just like you said, use arts and culture to raise awareness about, one, making sure that we get people the proper identification to vote, and making them understand that if voting wasn't important, that people wouldn't be organizing, you know what I'm saying, from the highest levels to try to prevent you from voting. And so one of the events we're doing is actually with the League of Young Voters, September 22nd. It's called Ignite in Pittsburgh. And we're doing a tour, and we're going to Pittsburgh and Philadelphia to use hip-hop artists like myself and D1, as well as, you know, bloggers like Andres Hale, Kimisario from The Source magazine, to try to draw people in and then talk to them about the importance of not just voting. I think that's where we get it twisted, because it's not just about voting. It's got to be the follow-up. And a lot of times, to me, the mistake we made, I think, in 08 is we voted, and then we partied and walked away. But what we have to do is vote, but then we have to demand that our vote be respected, and demand that our agenda be addressed. And I think that's the second part that we have to make sure that we do in 2012.
I want to ask both of y'all. I've seen y'all do the Ignite thing. And
we got to get you down, dude. We got to get you involved somehow.
But one of the things that I was impressed with, because I often hear people go, well, where are the young people and how come they're not doing things? And when you all do these things, I'm looking online and I'm seeing 30, 40, 50,000 people are watching you simultaneously. And that is tactics that you don't see normally with this leadership. Can you talk about that and the large amount of people that have, you know, come out to support, you know, these type of efforts? Because it's something that kind of goes underneath the radar, and then you wake up one day and realize you've amassed quite a bit of people.
Yeah, one of the cool things about hip-hop is that we're connected. I mean, it started back in, you know, I met you in 2000 at the Wisconsin, University of Wisconsin hip-hop thing, and we've continued to connect. And all across the country, a lot of these bloggers and hip-hop activists are connecting and talk to each other like friends. And all we've been able to do is aggregate their networks, link up with some big names like Ustream and get them to pay attention and help. And, you know, we're going to keep getting bigger. We're trying to get 100,000 views in basically a week, over a week's time. And the only way it will happen is because we got great partners like Ustream, like All Hip Hop, like Davey D, like One Hood, like a lot of other people, the well-versed.
Yeah, Margaret Prescott here. I'd like to, both of you to respond to this. Not all in our audience, but there are some in the Pacifica audience that are saying, well, why bother to go out and vote? A lot of people disappointed with President Barack Obama. They're angry, and they're saying, well, there's very little difference between the Democratic Party and the Republican Party, so why bother? And I'd like both of y'all to respond to that, since you're out there doing voter registration.
I will start with, you know, one of the things actually that the league has basically ran with is vote for yourself. I mean, I think that
we stole that from you.
Oh yeah, that was Paradise, the architect. Peace out to my man Dice. But I mean, the whole thing is like, one, it's not just when you're talking about voting, you're not just talking about voting for the White House. I mean, David D made a good point when we were at a BET town hall a few days ago about what about the judges in your area. What about the district attorneys in your area? What about the local people in your area that have access to millions of dollars that determine what's going on in your backyard? So I think people do that because they're not really educated properly politically. And they look at voting as something that we should just do 4 years when the president comes up, with the real elections that really matter right in your community, that determine the status of your school, the status of your community, whether you're getting snow removal in places like Pittsburgh and Milwaukee, or whether or not, you know, resources are allocated to people that are actually doing a job in your community, whether it's about stopping the violence or helping bringing people together. those are the things we should vote for. But first, I think we have to educate our people about the reality politically and how these people often are the ones allocating resources. And if we want to see those resources change, we have to get involved and we have to make our voices heard. And one of the way we make our voices heard is by who we vote for.
Yeah, the reality, Mr. Baker, who's the executive director of the
League. I like being called Mr. Baker.
Yeah.
No one calls me that. I'm just kidding.
That's it. Executive, I know nobody does, but I am, right?
I appreciate that.
Executive director of the League of Young Voters Education. I mean, what X says is all well and good, but November, everybody knows, is about the presidential election. When you're out there doing voter registration, all the pundits are saying that if the youth vote don't turn out, if the president's base don't turn out, that Romney Ryan are going to win.
That's right.
So what X is saying is very true. It's a point Davey has made. Excellent point. But when it comes to why should people register and participate in the presidential election process, what's your response?
I think there's a couple things. You got to look at the record. You know, I think if you look at some of the stuff Obama has done, it may not have been as transformative we'd like it to be, but the health care, you know, law is big. You can stay on your insurance till you're 26. You know, that's big. You know, my father, who is a cancer recovery, has opportunity now. If he, as an unemployed construction worker, has opportunity to get health insurance, it can't be denied. These are big things, and those are Obama talking points, but they're big things. I think the other thing is you need to look at what's happened in other regimes. I remember what it was like when George Bush II got in and how quickly school funds disappeared, how my fellowships disappeared. And these are big things, and if you think, honestly, if people think that this guy, Romney, is not going to come in and do some drastic things like Ronald Reagan and push for a bigger police state,
you're out
of your mind. These guys they're with it. They say we want our country back.
Right.
They're telling you what they're going to do.
Yep.
And if that doesn't inspire you, I don't know what will.
Pico, as we get ready to go, because I know you have to bounce, Paul Ryan, talk about that situation, because he's in your state, and just the whole, how's that going to play out with Wisconsin right now?
Here's a talking point that you hear from Wisconsin folks. Paul Ryan is a good guy. He's a family guy. He's a nice guy. He's a caring guy. But the truth of the matter is he is the ultra neocon. And that's cool if you're into neoconservative stuff. But he's also, if you look at his speech, he's not the most transparent and honest dude. And I think if we are fooled by his good looks or his good speech or, you know, the way they package him, we're going to be in a lot of trouble. And people know, who listen to this show or are on the hip-hop blogs, that I've had a lot to say about President Obama and how he's not been doing enough for specifically about black people pushing that narrative. But I also know it can get worse. And a guy like Paul Ryan, we're going to be in trouble. I'll just say that. From Wisconsin, I live in Janesville. For those who don't know, is one of the most racist places. The Klan is still there. I used to go there, play sports, play basketball, play soccer, and get called the N-word all the time in his hometown. So if you think a guy coming from that, a wealthy guy, not a working class guy, a wealthy guy from that town, doesn't have a plan, you're out of your mind.
Pico, we appreciate it. Jasiri, any last things? Or Margaret, you have
any? Well, a quick thing from Mr. X.
Yes.
I called you Mr. Baker, so I got to call him Mr. X
Mr.
now.
X.
in terms of the young women, you know, the sisters that you are doing outreach to,
right,
a lot of talk in this election about the war on women.
Yes.
Tupac has a song where he talks about his mother and he talks about struggling on welfare and all of that.
Right.
And I wonder if you have a comment in terms of the message to the young women and their involvement in voter registration.
Well, I mean, I think absolutely. I think, you know, when you see the Romney Ryan ticket, you see a ticket that's very, not just hostile to women, but very hostile to black people specifically. So now if you black and a woman, you're getting hit doubly. I mean, you know, the voter suppression laws is one thing. You have this language being used like Barack Obama's a full stamp prisoner and he wants everybody on welfare. And then you have these specific attacks on women and women's rights. And so if they're saying right now that they're going to not only take those rights away from you, but really take the safety net away from it. And that's what it is. A lot of times, you know, my mother, you know, when I was growing up, I grew up in a single parent household. And for a short period of time, my mother needed welfare to make it by before she ended up getting her master's degree. degree and becoming a senior marketing engineer. For that period of time, she needed welfare to get by. And so a lot of times that safety net is there for people not to be there their whole lives, but to help them through a hard period of time. And it's interesting, even when you talk about welfare, how it's framed, it's really a lot more white people on welfare, but they really want to take that safety net. And think about this. They want to take the millions of dollars that and they're really a small portion of the budget, and then give that to these billionaires who don't need it, but give more tax cuts, more benefits to billionaires. And so I would tell young women, don't listen to Nicki Minaj, you know what I'm saying, who said she wanted to vote for Romney.
Nicki Minaj, popular hip-hop artist. She came out and did a song about Romney yesterday.
Yeah, yeah, but you know, Nicki Minaj is in a different tax bracket, you know what I'm saying? Don't listen to her. Look at the record, like Biko said, and when you look at the record, that's what you have to base your vote on.
Jasiri X, we want to thank you. I know Biko had to bounce on out of here.
Yeah,
we're going to take a break here at our live coverage here in Charlotte, North Carolina. David D. and Margaret Prescott will be right back. So we're back here, and a lot of things going on. Everybody is waiting for Bill Clinton and Elizabeth Warren to come and take the podium. This is David E. as we are continuing our live coverage here from Charlotte, North Carolina on Pacifica Radio, along with Margaret Prescott and Mark Babawi. Also in the building with us is Mr. Evan Davis. How you doing, sir?
Doing all right.
You know, we've been talking for the past hour about voter suppression, and one of the things that's close to you is the Ohio situation. I want to see what you can kind of shed some light on regarding Ohio, since it is a major swing state in the upcoming contest.
Absolutely. Well, of course, that is my home state, and we're no stranger to voter suppression. It's taken many forms. In the election of 2004, of course, we had the long lines at the polls, so we have no reason to believe that that won't happen again this time.
And long lines because of what?
Long lines because of inequitable distribution of voting machines, not enough polling places, and of course, limited voting hours. Now, the previous Secretary of State, Jennifer Bruner, had expanded those voting hours. And so the election of 2008 went a lot more smoothly. But Republicans in the legislature now have been attempting to curtail those early voting hours. And we actually have one legislator who explained why. And he said, he quoted in the local paper, saying that the reason he wanted to curtail weekend and early voting hours was to avoid twisting the electoral system to accommodate, in his words, the African-American voter turnout machine.
You know, let me ask you this. I know with that sort of situation in terms of expanding the voting hours, wasn't it just recently the governor said that he's going to defy the orders? There were court orders that said he would have to expand it. He's defying that. Do you know anything about that? That's what we were hearing.
Right. Well, the Secretary of State issued an executive order making all of the voting hours or all the polling places across the state uniform. Now, that really doesn't apply because you have rural counties and urban counties and different circumstances in different counties. Also, different amounts of resources available to keep the polling places open or not. So the uniform policy really didn't make any sense. That was challenged by the Obama administration and local voting rights activists, and they prevailed in court. So a federal judge overturned that ruling and restored weekend voting hours. Now, the governor has made noises about trying to defy that order. That could just be so much posturing designed to sow confusion.
You know, when we talk about voter suppression, at least for the past hour, and a lot of the conversation and concern has been around the black community. But it seems like these tactics will also help will hurt other folks. You know, as you being an Ohioan, how will that impact people outside the black community?
Well, of course, there are people in rural communities who have to commute some distance to get to the polling places. There are plenty of people who are not people of color living in urban areas who work several jobs. I mean, poverty is not strictly defined along racial lines. You also have immigrants, you have students, you have people who travel for work. And so the early voting hours and weekend hours are really designed to accommodate the largest possible number of voters.
Well, there you have it. Evan, we appreciate you rolling through and speaking with us this evening. Here we are, live coverage from the DNC here in Charlotte, North Carolina. It is Pacifica Radio. Davey D hanging out with you along with Mark Babawi. And sitting in front of us from the great state of California, that's my home state for those of you outside of California listening, is our Senator Barbara Boxer. How are you?
I'm terrific. Thank you for having me on.
You know, we've been talking about voter suppression.
Yes.
And one of the big battleground states is Ohio, and history records that in 04, you were one of the folks to lead the charge against what you thought were some very quote-unquote questionable practices in that state. How are you seeing things now, especially with voter suppression laws popping up all over?
Well, let me put it this way. The greatness of our country is that we've been more and more inclusive throughout our history. We all know the history. We all know that only white men of property could vote. And, you know, it took us so long just to get the women's vote, 1920. And not to mention African Americans and so on. So at the end of the day, as you look at history, you know it's to include more people. That's what makes us stronger and better. And it makes us a true democracy. So what's going on in several states is clearly, it seems to me, a phony kind of a campaign to say that there's voter fraud when there's no voter fraud. Let's take Pennsylvania as an example, where we saw one of the legislators even admit the fact that this was part of their strategy to defeat President Obama. So my point of view is the Justice Department has to be very strong, has to, you know, bring these cases. We've been winning several cases. As a matter of fact, the last three that I looked at, we were winning.
Right. Is the Senate able to do anything? Do you have any sort of...
No, it's really not. It's because each state in our nation, each state is the one responsible through their Secretary of State and their laws. So what we can do is, if we believe that this is a civil rights violation, we would urge the Justice Department to get involved, and they have. And
right.
So far, they've won quite a few. Now, there are some states that have done voter ID laws that seem to be fair, but several of them are not fair,
right,
and it has to be stopped. And I'm feeling more encouraged today than I would have been if you had me on the show several weeks ago.
Okay.
So it looks like the courts are coming down on the right side on most of these cases. But I really do want to say to the folks who may be listening here, we're going to fight this, but we've got to get out and vote. We've got to do it, you know?
Right.
We it's sort of a tough issue for us. We have to fight and battle in the courts, but if we don't win, we have to do everything we can to get people to the polls.
Now, I want to bring something that's a little close to your heart, the environment.
Yes, please.
And I know that when we were down at the RNC, any chance they got, both on and off the stage, they demonize it, they ridicule it, climate change, the whole nine. Because so many people are brought into those lives, is this something that we're not going to hear too much about at this convention, or will this be addressed? Will this be addressed forthrightly and setting the record straight?
Well, let me just say this: Ken Salazar last night, who is our Interior Secretary, did speak about the beauty of our nation and the importance of preserving it. But there's no question that at this convention, I think we see the themes they're stressing more than others. You know, first and foremost, making sure people understand the choice. And the choice is between Romney and Ryan, who want to go back to the trickle-down economics, the voodoo economics that got us into this mess, you know, versus...
Well, voodoo economics. You want that back.
Yeah, I did. Well, I'm not the only one. But it's true. It really is. When you give to the top and you hope everybody succeeds after that, it doesn't work. It's been disproven. I think President Clinton will talk about that quite a bit tonight. We know it doesn't work, and President Obama talks about it. So why on earth would we elect the Romney-Ryan ticket, and if you just look at the economy and jobs? Or do you want to continue with President Obama, who really believes in investing in people, opportunity? You know, I thought the First Lady's speech, I don't know, did you get to see it?
Oh, yeah.
It was...
incredible.
It was so heartfelt. When she talked about, and I, as a mom and a grandma, I could relate to when she said, I was worried about my kids, because I went into politics when my kids were young. how could you protect your kids? And she talked about how she wanted to make sure that the kids were going to be protected, that they'd be in good shape, that they would be normal kids, that they wouldn't be tainted by the experience of the White House. But now, she says, after watching this man do his job, she realizes for the good of those children, in terms of their future, she needs to make sure that she works hard for this president and that basis. That's what it's about. Mitt Romney's going to go back to the past. We're going to go forward.
Right.
Can I jump in with a foreign policy question? We only have about a minute left.
Sure.
It tends to be seen from the outside world that the U.S. presidential election obviously has a big impact outside of these borders. And my question is about...
Outside of what? I missed what you said.
Outside of the country. You know, people outside of the U.S. who don't get to vote are still impacted by whichever party is in office. And my question is about the Israeli-Palestinian situation.
Sure.
And whether you think a second term would free the president to be a little bit more aggressive and effective in pursuing
them. Oh, I love what the president's done in the Middle East. He has stood tall for our relationship with Israel and for a two-state solution. I was fortunate enough to write legislation that underscores the importance of that. Two states side by side, living in peace and security, and making sure that Israel has that right to exist. Because I could tell you, I'm a little older than you are, and I well understand the history of the region.
I lived there, so I understand it pretty well, too.
You have a different perspective. I lost a lot of people in the Holocaust. Everybody has their own perspective.
Sure.
But I think this president understands the importance of standing by our allies and also pushing for a two-state solution. And I think he will continue to do that.
Do you think, along the same lines, how do you think overall, just with the Arab Spring, all the stuff that's jumping off in Egypt and all that, how do you think that will start to play itself out as if he gets
a
second term?
This is your last question, because we're being told you have to go.
If I knew the answer to that, I'd be a genius.
Right.
I think what the president has done has been the right thing.
Okay.
He sided with the forces of democracy, and now we have to make sure that those forces stay true to what they said they were going to do.
Right.
And I think this president understands. He's not going to get into some deal where he's polarizing people. Like, if you take the other question we had, it's polarizing question. Let's not polarize each other. Let's work together. And that's what I think this president will do and has tried to do. Bring us together, not tear us apart.
Senator Barbara Boxer, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Weighing in on the big issues here, right here on Pacifica. Live from the DNC, Charlotte, North Carolina, we are anticipating Bill Clinton speaking later tonight. We're looking forward to that.
Oh, yeah.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
It's a little frustrated.
Well, I was frustrated by two things. One was you sort of expect a non-answer when they're focused on the election. They don't want to talk foreign policy. They don't want to talk things that, as she puts it, that polarize people. But we also ran out of time, and that's kind of the format of the way things go. We're sitting here, and people come by, and they have 5 minutes, 6 minutes, and they have to leave, and you don't get to explore things very well. You mentioned when we were talking about same-sex marriage being recognized, that was a big step forward, and I really believe that, and I was very happy to see it adopted on the platform. But unfortunately, it was followed with two steps back today. That vote that happened, that was called three times and eventually passed, I think...
A little bit of controversy.
Not with a two-thirds majority as it was supposed to be. And the two issues that were kind of carried were to reinstate the word God into the platform and to recognize Jerusalem as the capital of Israel. I tried to catch up with Steny Hoyer as he was walking by and asked him about that vote, and he said it reflects President Obama's position and America's relationship with Israel. But, you know, even Israel doesn't say that Jerusalem is the capital officially. Tel Aviv is the capital. There are only two countries that recognize Jerusalem as the capital. So these are the things that I think are polarizing, not unifying.
Well, a lot of people were opposed, and you can hear that on the tapes, because they felt that this was a strong-arming thing from AIPAC, where there was actually a demonstration against earlier today.
Right.
So it's something that will probably be addressed a little bit more, but it's a little bit of a ripple right now.
Yeah, we're gonna come back to it. I know we're going to talk economics. For the next hour or so, but this is an issue that I'm sure we're going to revisit maybe later tonight.
Yeah, in fact, the representative from the Jewish Anti-Zionist Network will be joining us to discuss this very issue.
Yeah, so I don't want listeners to think that we've glossed over this. We're going to revisit it in about an hour and 20 minutes, roughly, but we're going to talk economics for a while, which we definitely need to, because Elizabeth Warren is coming up to speak, and we've got Richard Wolff and Dean Baker as well to discuss economics, so that's all very important.
We'll be right back right here with our live coverage on Pacifica Radio. This is Davey D, Margaret Prescott, and of course you just heard the voice of Mark Babawi. We'll be right back, folks.
This is WBAI in New York.
This is WBAI,
and you're listening
in New York,
to
listening
a rebroadcast.
To a special election edition of Earthwatch. I'm Robert Knight, and we now resume the coverage earlier this evening of the Democratic National Convention.
Coming to you live from the DNC in Charlotte, North Carolina, you're listening to Pacifica's national coverage. My name is Mark Grabowy, and joining me, of course, is Davey D and Margaret Prescott. We took a slightly longer break to give all of our stations time to identify themselves to you, KPFA, KPFT, KPFK, WBAI, and WPFW, as well as goodness knows how many other affiliates. We are joined live on the line for the next 15 to 20 minutes, and then for a little bit longer after that, by Richard Wolff. Let me welcome him first to the show, and I'll tell you a little bit more about him. Richard, are you there?
Yes, I am. Thank you, Mark, for inviting me.
It's good to have you back. I know I've had you on my show in Houston several times, and I know probably Margaret has as well, and I don't know if Davey has, but you should be no stranger to KPFT and Pacifica listeners in general. Richard is a professor of economics emeritus, University of Massachusetts Amherst. He's a visiting professor in the graduate program in international affairs at the New School University in New York. He's authored several books. His latest is Occupy the Economy, Challenging Capitalism. He's also written Capitalism Hits the Fan, which is one of my favorite recent books. Richard, we are going to be addressed here at the DNC fairly soon by Elizabeth Warren. She probably will touch a little bit on foreign policy, but I suspect mostly on the economy. I was on the floor today speaking with delegates about various things, including the bailouts, and the opinion seems to be that it was a necessary evil. We kind of had no choice. The financial system was going to collapse if we didn't bail out the banks. Why don't we start there? It's obviously a leftover from the Bush administration, but what did the president do, and what should he have done differently, perhaps?
Well, I think the remarkable thing is not only that the Obama administration rolled into office because of the nation's displeasure with the crisis and dissatisfaction with what the Bush administration had done, but then proceeded to do remarkable things. Number one, to keep in place the very architects of what the nation had voted against in terms of keeping in power all the old boy network at the Federal Reserve, at the banks in the United States, the policymakers, it's all the same people, and everyone kind of gasped when that was first done. Second, to continue the program of bailing out, only to make it much, much larger. And let me make a point about that. It is one thing to make an argument that there's an emergency and you have to bail out to some degree. But when you do that, there are several things you should do with it, none of which the Obama administration did. And I only mention two. One, how do you pay for a mammoth bailout? Number one, you could tax the richest corporations, the biggest, the wealthiest people in America, those who have done the best over the last 30 years, those who are in the least difficult position to pay such a tax. That would allow the government to intervene, but not to raise the national debt, which is a serious problem if all you do is borrow the money. The Obama administration chose not to go that way. And the second thing that could and should have been done with the bailout is to say, if we rescue all these immense banks, then once they're back on their feet, we are going to have to tax them in order to pay for what, in fact, was a bailout policy of which they were the best beneficiaries. None of that was done either. We are now in the peculiar position that the government claims it has to impose austerity on the American people to satisfy the problem of a debt which is held mostly by the banks that the same government used public money to bail out. That is nothing that the Obama administration ought to be proud of. It's really something they ought to be ashamed of.
Richard, my other key concern about this is the extent to which the disaster, the financial collapse, the meltdown, whatever you want to call it, the extent to which there are now regulations in place to prevent it from happening again. It doesn't seem like there are, and actually quite a lot of the delegates that I spoke to shared that position.
Absolutely. And again, the irony, the absurdity of it all, that when the Dodd-Frank bill, which is the major piece of legislation, passed under Obama's presidency to regulate. It is well known, it was public, that the banks who had been saved from collapse by the federal government used money that was unquestionably in part what they got from the government to lobby all of the senators and congressmen and women to make that bill less powerful, less intrusive, less powerful as a limiter of them. And it was a horrific demonstration of what I have now learned ever since the last great collapse of capitalism in the 1930s, that even if and when you pass legislation, tough as that is, then there is nothing to prevent these private banks from doing now what they did over the last 50 years. Weaken that bill, evade them, and then finally, as in the case of the Glass-Steagall Act covering banking, literally repeal it. And it is unfortunately necessary to say that the president who signed the bill repealing the last big regulation was Bill Clinton, whom you will see also at this conference, to say the least. So I think it's a terrible display of having not done what you should have done, and what the things you did do were done in such a way that you literally invite the kind of crunching on the mass of American people that passes for economic policy today.
For listeners who may be joining us, I just want to re-identify Richard Wolff. He's a professor of economics, author of multiple books, and also hosts a weekly hour-long radio program, The Economic Update, on WBAI, which is the Pacifica station, 99.5 FM in New York City. Richard, before we go to a piece, and I want you to stay on the line after we come back from that, I want to ask you just briefly about labor. The Democrats got a little bit of flack for hosting the convention in Charlotte, North Carolina, as a right-to-work state, and doesn't have a particularly good history of labor relations. Any comment on labor and you know how that is affected by things like conventions? And then we'll come back to you with some more questions in a minute.
Well, I think the tragedy of labor is captured in two things. Over the last 50 years, the number of people in the United States represented by organized labor has been on a literal straight line decline for 50 years. So that today the statistic is that in the private sector, less than 7% of workers are represented by a union. The catastrophe of the Bush years, of the crisis, and now of the Obama administration as well, is that none of that was fundamentally addressed. The weakness of labor in this situation, the inability of the unions to protect workers from being made to pay the price of a crisis they did not cause and of a bailout which bypassed them, that's the tragedy. And had there been an ability of the labor movement to extract from Obama something like a serious commitment to stop an economic policy that is 100% trickle down and actually focus what the government is doing by providing help to the people at the bottom, simply replicating what Roosevelt did in the 1930s, then you might have seen a reason for labor and labor unions to hope. But here we see nothing other than the old and unsuccessful preference of labor for a Democrat because they're so frightened by the Republicans, thereby giving the Democrats basically a free pass.
We're going to get into that in a little bit more detail, so I want you to stay on the line, please, if you don't mind.
We're
just going to go to the floor briefly. We're going to get some live remarks from Kamala Harris. She's the first African-American woman to be California's Attorney General. We're going to go to that just for a few minutes and come back to you.
Mitt Romney would have done if he were president, because he told us. He said we should let foreclosures, and I quote, hit the bottom. So the market could, I quote, run its course. That's not leadership. Doing nothing while the middle class is hurting, that's not leadership. Loose regulations and lax enforcement, that's not leadership. That's abandoning our middle class. Here's what President Obama did. President Obama won Wall Street reform to prevent any more tax-funded bailouts. President Obama won credit card reform so you don't get stuck with hidden fees and sudden rate hikes. President Obama stood with me and 48 other attorneys general in taking on the banks and winning $25 billion for struggling homeowners. That's leadership. That's what President Obama did. And that's why we need to give him another 4 years. We need to move forward. President Obama will fight for working families. He will fight to level the economic playing field and fight to give every American the same fair shot my family had. I remember when my mother, Shamala Harris, bought our first home. I was 13. She was so proud. And my sister and I were so excited. Millions of families and millions of Americans know that feeling of walking through the front door of their own home for the first time, the feeling of reaching for opportunity and finding it. That's the choice in this election. It's a choice between an America where opportunity is open to everyone, where everyone plays by the same set of rules, or a philosophy that tilts the playing field to help the wealthiest few. A choice between holding Wall Street accountable or letting it write its own rules. Mitt Romney subscribes to the cynical logic that says the American dream belongs to some of us and not all of us. Well, I'll tell you who the American dream belongs to. It belongs to the student in Sacramento who doesn't have much money, but who goes to bed each night dreaming big dreams. It belongs to the men and women across this country who know it shouldn't be against the law to marry the person you love. It belongs.
You're just listening to the voice of Kamala Harris. She is California Attorney General, the first African-American woman to hold that position. And we are rejoined, hopefully, by Richard Wolf. Are you there, Richard? Richard Wolf, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Okay, good. We have you back. You are listening, of course, to Pacifica's live coverage at the Democratic National Convention. My name is Mark Grabowie. My co-hosts, of course, are Margaret Prescott and Davey D. And our guest for hopefully the next 10 to 15 minutes, we hope. We're not sure exactly how long because things tend to change with a live program, is Richard Wolf. He's an economist, a professor, and an author, and a host of an hour-long radio program on WBAI, and you can catch that at 99.5 FM. Richard, you heard some of those remarks by Kamala Harris, and she was talking about foreclosures and the American dream of owning your own home, and trying to paint the election in terms of choices between the Democrats and the Republicans. What's your comment on what you heard, first of all?
Well, again, nothing I say should be interpreted as an endorsement or a preference for Mitt Romney. But having said that, I would have to say, with all due respect, it's sort of shameful what she just said. For example, that the Bush administration found its way to contribute $25 billion or to get the banks to do so, it's a little unclear the way she put it, to help in the foreclosure process. The banks, as everyone knows who follows this, have obstructed every effort of the Bush administration, which has permitted them to do so, so that the hundreds of billions that would have been necessary to make a real dent in the foreclosure problem were never provided. Number two, to talk in numbers like $25 billion may be impressive to people who are not familiar with what the numbers are. But let's compare the $25 billion made available to help folks in the who are suffering from foreclosure to what was done for banks in the United States. The simplest way to explain it is that between what the United States Treasury provided to banks and what the Federal Reserve provided to banks, the numbers are in the trillions with a T, dwarfing, rendering absolutely inconsequential by comparison was done for people at the bottom. Once again, the Obama administration subscribes to trickle-down economics. Help the big corporations. Boast about saving General Motors. By the way, a little footnote. When you save General Motors, you are, of course, not allowing the market to do its thing. You're intervening big time, but you're intervening in a big, special way. You're helping those at the top, the way they did with Bank America or Citigroup or Wells Fargo or any of the other monsters. And then the hope was by giving them loans and subsidies and investments of the trillions that it would all trickle down. We know after 3.5 years of the Obama administration, it was for the banks. Their stocks have rebounded in large part. The stock market has rebounded. But for the people at the bottom, the mass and the majority of Americans, this policy has not worked. And were these conventions about facing problems and coming up with real solutions, they would not be busy having speaker after speaker dance around the catastrophe and the crisis by pretending that things were done that weren't and that things were successful that have been raucous failures.
And of course, during all that talk of foreclosure, there was no mention of predatory lending, the responsibility of the institutions in causing the foreclosure crisis.
Fraudulent way that they got mortgages signed, then the fraudulent way that they prosecuted and foreclosed on people, the fact that courts all across the country have found them to be in violation, not only of the law in many cases, but of ethics of the most minimal sort. All of that is swept under the rug, and a small program that hasn't begun to do anything about the millions that have been thrown out of their homes. It's astonishing to hear this kind of celebration. It must grate on the people who know better, more than I could convey in my comments.
And of course, a lot of those people, the lowest rungs on the economic ladder are people who probably either should be or are in labor unions. We touched on that briefly, and I just want to bring in my co-host, David D., into this conversation because, David, you had a run-in with the labor secretary. Describe to the listeners what happened.
Well, we were coming in, and we just briefly got to talk with Hilda Solis. Thank you. I always wanted to, yes, Solis. We just briefly ran into her. And we wanted to talk to her about labor and ask her about the position with the unions. Of course, we get what I consider stock answers, but, let everybody hear this, and maybe Professor Wolf can comment on what she should have said.
Right.
This is a non-union state in many ways. What do you think can be done to increase the visibility of unions here and make labor, something that is more affordable and better for people?
Well, I think that just by us coming here and having the convention already sends a good positive message that it is about embracing work ethic and respect for workers and making sure that everyone has a fair shot at a good future, regardless of where you come from. And of course, we know unions have paid a big price in the last few years, but have contributed so much to the middle class. They are, in fact, the equalizers for many communities. So I come from a union background. My father was a shop steward in the Teamsters. But I know that it takes time for some places in the South. But it doesn't mean that we detour and we push back. We need to push forward, and we need to make sure that people get good salaries. We bring jobs home. That's why the president made such an investment with the automobile industry, bringing back Chrysler and GM and building those cars here with union membership and with people that understand what it is to produce a product that's made in the USA.
So that was, Hilda Solis. We were talking to her, Secretary of Labor. Richard Wolf, what do you think of that? My main point that I was really trying to get at, if you're going to come to North Carolina, why not use this opportunity and all this fanfare and all this resource to aggressively start setting up unions and getting people at least more educated as to what unions could be, but thoughts on what she answered or didn't answer.
Well, I first would comment on the fact that I cannot remember over the last several administrations a Secretary of Labor who has, in fact, disappeared during these years of Mr. Obama's rule. I mean, one hardly ever hears of anything that she says. One hardly ever hears of anything that the Labor Department was going to do. One of the few things that the labor movement asked of candidate Obama in the race up to his election in 2008 was a chance to kind of level the playing field and allow unions to be formed in a simpler way than running through the hoops that exist now. It's called the checkoff system. It's a simple system to allow workers to express their point of view, whether they want a union or not, in a simple, straightforward way. The unions gathered and said to Mr. Obama, this is the one thing that will enable to have a fair shot at organizing workers, particularly in the American South, where workers are very poorly and minimally organized. And the candidate said he would do it. The president never did it. To this day, that piece of legislation that was thought to be the basic minimum that this administration would provide to organized labor has not been passed, hasn't even been raised by the president. He has chosen not only not to make a strong fight, he's made no fight for it at all. That is a concrete step he could have and should have taken. It is something that the Secretary of Labor can and should support. Neither the President nor the Secretary had a word to say about it. These descriptions of how you come from a working class family or from a labor union family, look, that doesn't shake it. That doesn't make the difference. The question is, what are you doing now to do something about equalizing the struggle between highly organized major multinational corporations on the one hand, stronger than they've ever been, so large and powerful that they can shape what the government does, that they get described by phrases like too big to fail, and on the other hand, at the end of a 50-year decline, a weak, a poor labor movement. Simple notions of fairness could allow the government to change that relationship in little ways, like checkoff, like what the unions asked. But the sad reality is that they're more responsive to the business community's hostility to doing anything for labor than to the labor movement itself, counting, as always, on the unions preferring them to the Republicans and not realizing that that's a recipe for getting less and less and less with each passing year.
Richard Wolf, we really appreciate that. You definitely broke that down. Margaret?
Yeah, Richard Wolf, Margaret Prescott here.
Hi.
And hi. Yeah, good to hear you. Richard, I always like to bring it back to the systemic issue because I don't know since when we have come to depend on people in the halls of power without the street heat. I know I've heard you, I've interviewed you about what's happening on Greece, you know, people tearing up the streets, what's going on in Spain. And it does seem as though here in the United States, there's this complacency. You elect somebody who is the leader of the strongest capitalist state in the world, and then you sit on your hands and that street heat doesn't happen. But even FDR, I don't know of any president in the United States who did anything to move anything forward without street heat. And just in terms of solutions, I wanted your comment on that.
Well, I couldn't agree more. And the best way to explain it is from American history. In 1932, when we were in a depression much worse than we're in now, although who knows how bad this one will get. But there we were in 1932. And a middle-of-the-road Democratic president, that's what he was, Roosevelt. He believed in a balanced budget, all of that. Comes into power, and within a year and a half, he changes. Why did he change? How did he change? Very simple. He decided in the midst of a depression, when everybody said there was no money, just like they do today, and everybody said the government should do less, just like the politicians say today, Mr. Roosevelt surprised everybody. In the midst of a depression, he created the Social Security system, giving millions of Americans over 65 money for the rest of their lives. And he created the unemployment compensation system, giving millions of unemployed people a check every week. And then he created and filled 12.5 million jobs. Everything that Republicans and Democrats today seem to agree can't be done, President Roosevelt did. And the way he paid for it was by taxing rich people and corporations. And what reward did that politician get from doing that? He was the most popular president in American history, the only president to be reelected by the American people four times in a row. The Republicans were so freaked out they had to pass a law after he died to limit American presidents to two consecutive terms. What made him do it? And Margaret, your analysis is exactly right. What made him do it was something phenomenal that happened in the 1930 period, in the Depression. First, we had the greatest of organizing workers into trade unions we've ever had before. The Congress of Industrial Organizations, the CIO, mobilized, organized tens of millions of American workers who had never been in unions before. And the basic idea was, capitalism is falling around you. It is going to take you down unless you're organized and can fight back. So people joined unions. And the second and third things we had in the 30s was a powerful surge of socialist parties and the American Communist Party. That's our history. The socialists, the communists, and the unionists worked together, and they mobilized and represented millions of Americans. And they went to the president, and in your wonderful phrase, Margaret, they applied some street heat. They had demonstrations. They did in this country what the Spanish people are doing today, what the Greek people have been doing for the last 2 years, and they're making sure there, as they did in the 1930s in this country, that when it comes time to dealing with a breakdown of the economic system, it's not going to be the mass of working people who have to pay the cost, suffer the consequences of something they didn't bring about. So yes, I agree with you. Unless and until the American people find independent ways to apply pressure, they cannot expect, neither from the Democrats nor from the Republicans, a fundamental change, which is what they need if they're not experiencing a crisis that will damage them and their children for years to come.
Well, Richard Wolff, we are, I'm afraid, out of time, but I really want to thank you for being with us tonight, and I appreciate all of your comments. For people who wanted to hear more of Richard, go to his weekly hour-long radio program on WBAI. Thanks so much.
Thank you, and good luck with the rest of your coverage.
Thank you.
And now, an important Election Day announcement from the billionaires.
I keep flashing back on Y2K, when the billionaires took your voting rights away. Convicted felons got personal lists. A lot of innocent people's names were dismissed.
If you're satisfied, felonious acts of the billionaires here, reporting from Charlotte. If you're wondering why a small, hearty contingent of billionaires has decamped in Charlotte for the Democratic convention instead of sipping ginger ale at Mitt's vacation home at Lake Winnipesaukee, let me assure you that we are bipartisan. We buy Democrats as well as Republicans. This is especially true in years like 2008, when our Republican officials have been promoting our agenda so effectively that large swaths of the American people get the urge to ride them out of town on a rail. If we expect to protect our billionaire agenda from the tyranny of the majority, we need to cultivate some Democrats who will work tirelessly on our behalf. The press describes these Democrats as centrist, but it's not like they're straddling some territory between being pro-gay marriage and anti-gay marriage. They're really corporatists. They pander to the same socially liberal causes as their fellow Dems, but when the time comes, they vote on our behalf to deregulate and privatize and outsource and downsize. One such Democratic hero to the billionaire cause was Senator Max Baucus. As a leading recipient of money from our health insurance companies, Max was the only thing that stood between our continued huge profits and the nightmare of real, comprehensive, universal health care in America. And they don't call Joseph Lieberman the senator from Aetna for nothing. Although it's nice to keep a small collection of Democratic congressmen amid our much larger one of Republicans, when push comes to shove, we gravitate toward the Republican brand because the Democratic base is so pro-union. And even our own billionaire-friendly Democrats are forced to pay lip service to an anti-corporate message from time to time. The Republican base is mostly social conservatives, and they don't seem to have any objection with voting against their financial self-interest for guys who will further ours. So we're writing our biggest checks to Republicans. And if the Democrats in our collection get shellacked this year, they can count on a nice, fat sinecure with us as corporate lobbyists next year. This has been Felonious Acts of the Billionaires, reporting from Charlotte.
If you really want to fight in the war, if you like the way we're treating the poor, if you don't care about education,
hey, the billionaires don't want you to vote.
You've been listening to a special election edition of Earthwatch on WBAI New York, or possibly WBAI.org, featuring certain developments of controversy earlier this evening at the Democratic National Convention in Charlotte, North Carolina. I'm Robert Knight in New York, inviting you to stay tuned for Hour of the Wolf with Jim Freund.
And that program was brought to you live with portions on recording. Good morning. This is Hour of the Wolf, a Wednesday night, Thursday morning program dedicated to science fiction, fantasy, enchantment, and the imagination. My name is Jim Freund. Another one in our series of interviews from this year's Nebula Awards weekend, where I conducted about, a dozen or so, and this one, great writer, Joe Haldeman. Stay tuned. Again, good morning. So this is Hour of the Wolf for, well, technically it's Thursday, so it's September 6th. It's always one of those which is it kind of things, because to me, it's Wednesday. You know, I got up It was Wednesday afternoon. I'm doing a show tonight. But it's after midnight. That makes it Thursday morning, unless I have a guest on the phone, in which case it's, well, whatever time it is there. Next week, I hope to have a guest on from California. And so it'll be Wednesday night for that person, certainly. So, and I should explain that. Some months ago, I did an interview with yet another one of the greats in science fiction, John Shirley. And I was waiting for a while to put it on so I could get a reading. He did a reading in May at the New York Review of Science Fiction Readings. And the reading he did was absolutely wonderful, and without any changes in Pacifica policy, also unbroadcastable. Although, actually, since we're in what they call safe harbor now, I ought to talk to the program director about that and see if Pacifica policy may perhaps change. Since certainly the FCC policy has changed, perhaps Pacifica programming policy will change. I wouldn't hold my breath, but it hopefully can't hurt to ask. At any rate, I recorded an interview with John as well at that time, and he's been writing me, asking me why I haven't yet broadcast it. And I've been writing him back and getting no response. Apparently there's some kind of technical glitch. I've been getting his emails. He hasn't been getting mine. I used a different account, then he got mine. So we're in touch again. And I said, listen, within 2 weeks, I'll be sure to put it on. And now I can't find the interview for other technological reasons. John doesn't know this yet, unless, of course, he's listening to this show. And I'm sure somebody will tip him off. So I'm going to call him or write him and see if we can have him on live. If I cannot do that for next week, and if I do not find that, so next week should be John Shirley. If I do not find that, well, tomorrow afternoon, thanks to Tor Books, I'm going to be recording an interview with a couple of writers you may have heard of, Cory Doctorow and Charles Strauss. Either one of whom could easily get, you know, a 2 or 5 hour show, but we'll be recording about a 90-minute interview tomorrow, and or maybe even a little longer, and break it up into two shows. That might be a good idea. We'll have to see how that works out. But I'm actually, Tor has actually sandwiched me, get this, between, before me, they're over at Google doing one of Google's little TED-like seminars. And after that, when I'm done recording those two guys, the New York Times is going to be interviewing them. So it's like, okay, fine. At any rate, I have nothing to complain about since August, since we came back from our last July long thon. We have had, I am proud to boast, great show after great show. In order, Daniel Jose Older came in and read from his new collection of stories, his first collection of stories, and new one, A Salsa Nocturna. And he's doing, by the way, another performance of stuff from that work at the New Yorican Cafe. I went to the first one. It was a sellout, and it was wonderful. And he and I are talking about doing some other production, studio production on that, which was very cool. And this is just, you know, a great new voice in science fiction fantasy. So I was very, very proud and pleased to present that. He's also really, really good jazz composer and performer. Then, the week after that, Norman Spinrad. The week after that was Harlan Ellison. Then, Connie Willis. And last week, Michael Bishop. And the hits just keep coming. Some of these were live. Some of these were on the phone. I tend not to do phone interviews. I don't like them. The problem with phone interviews and an interview like the one that we're going to hear this morning is they don't include readings. Now, we did do short fiction last week with Michael Bishop live on the phone. And by the way, I'm curious. You can call me up as we hear the Joe Haldeman interview. How anybody who heard last week's show, how you think that went? I am generally unhappy with the idea of reading fiction on the phone. What I'm going to try to do with John Shirley for a reading that is broadcastable also, is he lives in San Francisco. So I'm going to see if I can get him over to our sister station, KPFA, and have him record there, have it sent here, and then we'll have studio quality. But we're going to work that out. So I'm just mentioning all this because, well, gee, I'm darned proud over the programs we've had in the last few weeks. Coming up besides Charles Stross and Cory Doctorow. Aside from that is Mary Robinette Kowal, which is another Nebula interview. And we have some interesting live possibilities as well. Also, an event in person, live, in front of your very face. If you, wonder what that's about. If you care to show up next Tuesday, and if you'd like to have fiction read to you, well, then, here's a wonderful opportunity. Richard Bose, and Carlos Hernandez will be reading for the New York Review of Science Fiction Readings, which is a monthly event that I produce. Usually it's once a month, but in September, we're doing two readings. The next one will be because Roz Kaveni is coming in. Actually, she's coming in from Seattle, but she's from London and is a fascinating, charismatic poison. And also Deborah Grabian, who basically turns, among other things that she writes, the King.